Walker. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand that the council have all checked in with the clerk. So without any further ado, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you very much. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Hutchinson seeks relief under Section 1117A of the Lanham Act. That provision provides the district courts may award attorney's fees in, quote, exceptional cases. The issue before this court today is the limit of a trial court's discretion with regard to the determination of what is and is not an exceptional case under the statute. The Supreme Court has repeatedly, the United States, has repeatedly held that a litigant like Hutchinson that files suit in state court seeking relief under a federal statute is entitled to the full benefit of federal law. We submit that Hutchinson did not receive those benefits here. The Fifth Circuit, and really every court, federal court that's addressed this issue, has held that a plaintiff that prevails in a Lanham Act case is entitled to attorney's fees if it shows by a preponderance of the evidence that the case is exceptional. Last year, the Fifth Circuit in Spectrum decision held that it is an abuse of discretion for a trial court not to find that a case is exceptional, where the record shows that the defendant willfully violated the Lanham Act, and the record contains evidence that the defendant took untenable positions and or kind of resisted appropriate discovery. I'll refer to this kind of as just the willful plus standard. It's just kind of conceptually a way I'll describe it.
Well, speaking of conceptual, let me interrupt you and just ask. I know that you're taking the position that Hutchinson is entitled to its fees as a matter of law.
Yes, ma'am.
Basically, and yet the district court is operating. We're reviewing what Judge Fahey did for an abuse of discretion.
Yes, sir.
So help me square that circle.
So just I want to make sure I understand your question. You're asking why is it, what makes it an abuse of discretion?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're wanting us to say something as a matter of law, essentially, when she had the discretion to listen to all of your reasons why you were entitled to fees and she said no.
Understood. So I think that if this court decides that the Fifth Circuit's decisions are if not controlling, certainly persuasive, and it wants its decisions to be consistent with the Fifth Circuit's law in this space, then Judge Fahey's decision we submit is inconsistent with the court's decision in Spectrum, which was handed down last year. As I just mentioned there, the court held that it is an abuse of discretion. So they reversed the trial court where the record contained essentially, they noted that the violation was willful of the Lanham Act, and then there was some minor discovery abuses, essentially. And Fifth Circuit's result there was that Fifth Circuit deemed that an abuse of discretion. So we submit that to the extent that this court wants its law to be consistent with Fifth Circuit law on this, we believe our case is more extreme and presents more extreme factors than were present in that case. And therefore, it would be inconsistent for this not to be an exceptional case.
And that was a federal trial court that they overturned.
That's Judge Albright. That's exactly right.
Judge Albright in Waco.
In Waco, and it was a bench trial too. So actually, like it was all of his discretion, and despite all of that, and despite the fact that I will just say, like the willful plus, the plus factors that we were kind of talking about earlier, the discovery thing, they weren't that extreme in the Spectrum case. We certainly don't believe that there was extremes here, and yet, nevertheless, the court reversed the trial court and held that it was an abuse of discretion.
You're arguing that there was more discovery abuses in this case than that.
Certainly. That is certainly our position. I think that in that case, there are kind of two issues, right? The plus factors are either the strength of its litigating position. A party case can stand out for the strength of its litigating position in terms of evidentiary, like, and that's really just and the Spectrum decision, the Fifth Circuit noted that there was the overwhelming evidence against the defendant illustrates the sheer strength of the litigating position. In other words, it was a very one-sided case. Well, you will hear no, I don't think you're going to hear anything today from DBL that suggests that they had a credible dispute about whether or not we owned the trademark or that there was a likelihood of confusion. It was really, they tried it as a damages case, not, so, I mean, the evidence was overwhelming here, just as it was there. So that's the strength of the litigating position. And then on the discovery issue that you just kind of raised, in Spectrum, they cited inconsistent, misleading, or inaccurate answers to written discovery, including not admitting that Spectrum was a competitor, failing to identify the clients they obtained from Spectrum. That's quoting from the Spectrum decision. And yet, here we have, did they refuse to identify customers? Yes, they did. We had to brief extensively a motion to compel the identity of the people to whom these products were sold, in other words, potential witnesses to the case. And they claimed it was a trade secret, and then they, I think more revealingly, they said the identity of these customers were not, quote, relevant to the fair adjudication of Hutchinson's claims. That's 1 CR 120. So we had to file a detailed motion to compel there, and the court granted it in full. Then they moved for protection from a third-party subpoena. In other words, we had agreed with a third party about which they'd already produced documents. So we already had the documents from them. And they said we were going to take their deposition voluntarily, and they were going to produce additional documents. Filed a motion to quash the subpoena on the basis that that too was a trade secret. Yet the only evidence of their trade secret status is possible under the law to have a trade secret with a third party that doesn't defeat trade secret status. But in this case, the only evidence that they attached to their motion to quash was a NDA that was signed by one of DBL's own employees. So there was no, like, they didn't even pretend to have any relationship with or of confidentiality agreement. And yet we had to file a response to that motion to quash, a pretty detailed one, 5 or 6 pages, again, running up the costs on something that we really shouldn't be fighting about. Then we get to kind of along those same lines when it came time to inspection. They took the position they didn't have any relevant products, which is just flatly not true. We had a ton of discovery that said they had relevant products. Once we filed our motion to compel, suddenly they dropped their opposition and they allowed us to do it. But that's only after we filed a 10 or 12 page motion to compel on this issue. That's not reasonable litigation conduct. But I think for me, if there's one thing that makes this truly remarkable, it's the antitrust claims. The antitrust claims are not only filed after the end of discovery in this case, which I think is bad. I mean, I just do. Untimely antitrust claims are incredibly complicated. To file them after the end of discovery seems very unreasonable. But, and this is from the Alliance Fifth Circuit decision, they say counterclaims without any actionable conduct. Okay, so they allege we violated the Texas Free Enterprise Act and the Antitrust Act of 1983 and the Clayton Act by, quote, filing suit against DBL, seeking not only to restrain certain sales by DBL, but also to recover an amount of damages which in reasonable probability would force DBL out of business. And then essentially by claiming that we were talking to their customers as part of the litigation. So the only conduct that they claimed violated the antitrust laws here was litigation conduct. Except the Supreme Court of the United States has handed, and they, in their responses, they claimed to have known this when they filed these. Supreme Court of the United States and the Norr-Pennington Doctrine says litigation conduct is protected under the First Amendment unless you can make a two-part showing. The first is you have to show our claims were objectively baseless when we were filed. So that means that's the first thing. Before they can even talk about what our reasons were for filing the lawsuit, they had to point to evidence that our claims were objectively baseless. They cannot have had a good faith basis for believing that. I mean, it's just the record precludes that from being the case. Before, and I'll give you some cites here, they were sued about by a different customer over these products because the customer was confused and was told and claimed it wasn't told about the origin and what these products were by another customer before this lawsuit was even filed. Not the counterclaims, I mean the lawsuit, our claims. Daniel Little, during his deposition, before these counterclaims were filed, admitted that there was confusion. He admitted that he called infringing products Hutchinson products. Hutchinson laid out its own evidence of ownership and its confusion in a motion to compel, the one we've just discussed. That was filed with a bunch of evidence attached. That's 1 CR 79 through 101, if you'd like to see the evidence that was attached to that. That was filed and litigated before they filed their antitrust claims. They sat through depositions Again, they sat through these depositions before they filed their antitrust claims. By the time that they filed it, they knew that there was, they stipulated to the first prong of our cause of action, which was we owned a trademark. And then they came back and then they sat through all these depositions, been sued and settled a lawsuit about confusion. Those are our two elements. And yet they brought the claims anyway. And not only did they bring the claims, but they actually asked for time to brief it additionally. They asked for more time to do discovery so that they could go gather more evidence about Hutchinson's subjective intent. In other words, that's the second prong of the Knorr-Pennington test. They weren't even, you have to get past the objective standard first. They didn't even try to do it. If you actually look at their briefing, the only, and I think that you will, it's worth pointing out that in DBL's response, Appellee's brief, you won't see a substantive defense legally of their claim. They essentially say, we did it in good faith. Whether they did it in good faith or not doesn't make it any less unreasonable. I mean, I think that the evidence that I just laid out for you suggests that perhaps it was done in something less than good faith, and I want to be clear, these lawyers did not represent them at the time, so that is nothing to do with these lawyers. But nevertheless, just because you did it in good faith doesn't make what you did reasonable or appropriate. And this clearly wasn't. And it cost me, I wrote the briefing myself. This took a huge amount of time because they're antitrust claims, and it's very difficult to beat back very, very broadly pleaded antitrust claims when you don't really know what they're alleging and you're going through. It is also worth noting that this is not in the briefing, but in their papers, in addition, even assuming that they could have gotten past that prong of the Knorr-Pennington test, right? They can actually get to the actual substantive claims. The elements of an antitrust claim involve defining and proving relevant market and monopoly power in the market. And the words market and market power and relevant market don't appear in their response. To our no evidence motion for summary judgment. They didn't even try to respond to that. And I will just say that give you a little context of when this came up. This was on the eve of a mediation that they had requested. So I don't know whether DBL wanted to get some leverage in the mediation. I don't know what their motives were, but I do know that the effect was a huge amount of briefing that had to be done, two hearings, and from our perspective, that is more unreasonable. That particular act is more unreasonable than any single act undertaken in any of the cases cited in either party's brief that led to an exceptional case finding.
And this was something that was before, because y'all put forward your request for the court to consider this exceptional twice, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And the court was privy to this both times.
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
Would this have been a situation where findings of fact and conclusions of law would have been helpful, or is that even appropriate in a motion to declare something an exceptional case?
I can tell you, I don't think that that was certainly something that was required. I can tell you that in federal court, the Georgetown case, which is a district court case, I believe, out of the Eastern District of Texas, the court did say that in willful cases, this is a district court, not an appellate court, but I believe that the judge did point out there was some authority, which is in a willful case, when you're not going to deem it exceptional, in other words, when the district court is deciding not to deem it exceptional, the court should articulate some basis for doing so. I am not submitting to this court that that is what...
Finding.
Right, exactly. But I'm just kind of to your question. I don't think that there's a whole lot of dispute about the underlying facts.
So I assume that that the hearing on your most recent motion, which... we don't seem to have a record of. I mean, there wasn't anything. Looking at the order, it doesn't appear that there was anything evidentiary about that hearing whatsoever.
That's correct, Your Honor. We did the best we could. I think, and in fairness to Judge Fahey, the Lanham Act has a different statutory kind of framework. It's different than the garden variety. It's not a sanctions hearing. And I don't know. I think we briefed it okay, but I can understand why a trial court, a state district court, who's not dealing with this Lanham Act all the time and is hearing, I want fees, essentially. That's functionally what we're there asking for. And a district court hears that all the time. And most state trial courts appropriately kind of say, no, like, we get it. You want fees, but go away. So I don't want to suggest that there's anything that there was any willful or anything of that sort. But I do think that, particularly after Spectrum, I think for us, Spectrum, because that sets the bounds of what has to be, as a matter of law, exceptional.
Have there been any other post-Octane cases other than Spectrum where a trial court was reversed for not declaring an exceptional case?
No, Your Honor, and as far as I'm aware, that's the first time it's happened, perhaps in the United States. I couldn't find any other circuits that have reached that kind of reverse side of the coin. There's a lot about what the trial courts have tons of discretion to award them. There's less about what's the line here and when do you have to. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time if that's okay.
Well, real quick question.
Sure.
And it's not huge, don't look this up, but if off the top of your head, how much of your time and how much of those attorney's fees was actually you responding to the antitrust stuff?
It took me a week to, I can remember it took me a full week to write the first preliminary summary judgment motion, because I had to figure out how to learn antitrust law, which I don't know, by the way. I know more about it now. And then we did it twice, so it was briefed twice. And if you look at the record, you'll see that it was briefed fully twice. So there is a full no evidence, like summary judgment, and then they amended their response, so we had to basically redo it. So there's a full motion, a reply, a full motion, and a reply.
So just a large amount.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Austin Champion, and I represent the appellee, DBL Designs, LLC. The Lanham Act creates a flexible standard for courts to determine whether or not something is exceptional. It provides the courts with broad discretion to make that determination. And I think it's important to note off the front that a finding of willfulness by the jury or the trial court alone is insufficient to deem a case exceptional. We know that because the text of the Lanham Act talks about in that provision regarding an award of fees.
Well, it might not be sufficient to deem a case exceptional, but am I remembering correctly that there was some suggestion, maybe in Spectrum, maybe somewhere else, that willfulness alone can support an exceptional finding?
I think Spectrum does say that, but what's interesting...
But it doesn't have to.
What's interesting about Spectrum, and I'm going to go straight into this because you asked, and I think it's very relevant to what they just argued, Spectrum doesn't apply the correct standard that's been handed down from the Supreme Court in Octane Fitness through the Fifth Circuit in Baker. In fact, Spectrum applies the pre-Octane Fitness standard regarding bad faith and willfulness. So I think Spectrum's an interesting case as an outlier because it's the wrong standard, one. And two, it reaches a conclusion on its own that no other court in the Fifth Circuit has ever reached, or Texas courts for that matter. And that is, one, looking at post-trial misconduct and saying that that is somehow relevant to the analysis of willfulness and bad faith, which aren't the standard.
Well, but post-trial conduct is just one aspect of what the appellant's arguing. Isn't that right?
I think it is, without a doubt. And I intend to go through this in a second with you. I just wanted to jump right into this issue of Spectrum since it was just fresh on the mind. Wrong standard does something that no other Fifth Circuit court has done. And so we have to look at the right standard. We have to look at what Baker and Octane Fitness and all the other cases that have been decided since then have said. And that is that we look at the strength of the party's litigation position, and we look at the litigation conduct. So I want to talk about that, and I want to start with the strength of litigation. The trial record shows that DBL bought used wheels from Hutchinson, from military surplus providers. It modified those wheels and it sold them, and it told customers that they were Hutchinson wheels. The owner believed this was accurate, and in his words at trial, just like a Chevy truck that you modify, still a Chevy truck. Not a sophisticated answer, but I think it shows his intent and his state of mind. Now, a non-unanimous jury, only 10 out of 12, found that DBL infringed Hutchinson's mark and engaged in unfair competition. And a non-unanimous jury found that DBL acted willfully. However, the jury unanimously found that DBL did not act with malice or gross negligence.
Yeah, I meant that was a question I meant to ask Mr. Golan. I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher.
Golinkin,
thank you. So is there anything that we should infer or anything in the case law on Lanham Act exceptional cases because of a willfulness finding on infringement versus a finding of no malice or gross negligence for punitives? Is there any overlap in those concepts?
I think there is, and I think you have to look at it with the lens of the court's discretion. And again, because we're looking at the weight or the strength of one party's litigation position, I think it is relevant to the trial court's exercise of discretion that the trial court knew that a jury did not find that the conduct rose to an even higher level. So I think, yes, it is relevant. Now, is there a Fifth Circuit case I can point you to on that issue? No, I'm not aware of that. But I think here today, given that you have such a blank slate to look at the law, I think it's appropriate to consider that. Now, every court since Octane Fitness looks to the sound discretion of the trial court. And I want to talk about what the trial court had in front of it when it exercised discretion in denying this application for an exceptional case. So, unlike the defendant in the Alliance for Good Government case, DBL did not independently adopt a mark similar to Hutchins, and it didn't adopt anything at all. It simply resold a wheel that it changed and left everything intact. Didn't even modify the mark to change it. Hutchinson did not have a registration for its mark at the time. And DBL sold these modified wheels to different customers, largely civilian and local government customers, and not the U.S. government, which was the majority of Hutchinson's business. Now, separately along these lines, DBL did not create marketing materials that traded on Hutchinson's name. DBL didn't buy domain names and attempt to confuse customers. DBL didn't attempt to sell its wheels to the U.S. government. Now, looking back at this court's prior decision, I think there are additional distinguishing factors. For example, when DBL found out that Hutchinson complained about its sale of wheels bearing the Hutchinson mark, it stopped immediately. And then it agreed to a temporary injunction in this case, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that it had ever violated today. Since the entry of...
Is there a motion for contempt still pending on something?
There is, relating to the permanent injunction. I'll come back to that in a second, or I can talk about it now.
I just was curious if it was still pending.
Sure. It has not been decided. But there's no doubt whatsoever that DBL stopped using or allowing the wheels it sold to bear the Hutchinson mark from moment one. That was a key factor in Astoria from this court, the fact that the defendant continued using the mark after being notified. And unlike the defendant in Astoria, who purportedly knew that its conduct was wrong and knew what it was doing was trading on the goodwill of that, it was, frankly, maybe not sophisticated enough to realize that modifying something and putting it in stream of commerce could be actionable. Now, the trial court was aware of all of these factors, and it had the discretion to consider them, put them in the mix, pour them out. It has that discretion.
How much did Hutchinson sink in damages?
Funny you should ask. It's the next point on my outline, so let me go right there. I think the jury's analysis of this case is also very the judge saw. To your question, at closing argument, Hutchinson asked the jury to award $576,000 in lost profit damages. The jury awarded nothing. Hutchinson asked the jury to award it $829,000 in disgorgement damages for unfair competition. The jury awarded it nothing. Hutchinson also asked the jury to award it $829,000 in disgorgement damages for trademark infringement, and the jury awarded only $80,994. Less than 10% of what it asked for with respect to just that claim. Less than 10%. Now, the only thing that stands out about this case with respect to strength of litigation position is how little Hutchinson received compared to what it asked for. The trial court had the discretion to look at all of this and determine whether or not this case was exceptional, and that discretion, that decision, should not be disrupted by this court. Now, I want to talk about this litigation misconduct. Let me start with the discovery issues, the second prong, if you will, of our analysis. In this Georgetown Rail Equipment Company case that they talked about earlier, the court said, and I think it's notable, quote, there's nothing exceptional about a party resisting its discovery obligations, maintaining already rejected objections to exhibits or testimony into trial, filing weak Daubert requests, or even making repeated Rule 11 sanction threats. That's from the court. And I think that's important because every good lawyer in litigation has to walk this invisible line between being a zealous advocate and being overzealous as an advocate. And I think there's a big difference about advocating versus perhaps weaponizing the trial process for the benefit of a client.
What about filing an antitrust counterclaim after the end of discovery?
Right. And let me address that. I'll go straight to the antitrust issue. So I think what they've told you in oral argument is half the story. The antitrust claim speaks to their actions in litigation, and they had a defense to that under this Norr-Pennington doctrine. There's another side of this, too, which was, and this was briefed in response to their motion for summary judgment claim, that Hutchinson had gone out and contacted suppliers who were reselling wheels and telling those suppliers not to sell wheels to DBL while they were simultaneously reselling these used Hutchinson wheels to others. It did this because apparently, as the record evidence shows, allegedly, they were telling these suppliers that these wheels were failing and jeopardizing life or causing injury to others. Now, DBL also alleged and supported by affidavit evidence in its response that Hutchinson was going to purchasers or customers of DBL and was telling similar stories that you can't buy these wheels, they're wildly unsafe, and they could kill your customer. Now, at trial, there wasn't evidence to show that any wheel had ever failed or had caused any catastrophic injury whatsoever. And so at the time, based on the evidence that was known, this was pretrial, to DBL, we submit it was very reasonable to assert a claim that Hutchinson was attempting to navigate itself in the marketplace and shut off a small company from buying its wheels, modifying and reselling them.
Did you just say that DBL knew that before trial? So when did DBL find this out? Was this during discovery? I mean, was it at the end of discovery when they found this out? I'm just curious about the timing of filing that kind of a huge counterclaim.
Sure, and I would be reluctant to tell you exactly when. I don't know that it's clear in the record. I suspect there would be filings throughout that reference these types of things.
I understand you weren't trial counsel.
So. Well, that's no excuse, but I think here's what I can tell you. What I can tell you is that there was the discovery dispute where Hutchinson wanted access to customer lists of DBL. My suspicion would be it occurred after that time, based on what's being said in the affidavits and in response to the motion for summary judgment. Now, I think it's safe to say that there were two prongs to this argument that was raised in the amended or in the counterclaim, one being the litigation conduct being improper, the other being the ancillary conduct that was arguably outside of litigation, that conduct being directed to customers and suppliers and telling them alleged untruths about the wheels. That is what I think justifies the conduct and filing the counterclaim and resisting the summary judgment motion. And as you know, look, they lost. DBL lost. Standing alone, that happens. You know, I wish I didn't lose anything I filed, but it happens. It happens to everyone. And I don't think we can look to that issue alone and say this is an exceptional case. Antitrust counterclaims are pretty common in trademark disputes. It's not out of the ordinary to pursue one. They lost on summary judgment, and they proceeded to trial. Backing up to the discovery issues, though, I want to talk for a second about this motion to compel. What I think is important to note is that they served discovery requests, DBL objected, they filed a motion to compel, and so they responded to that motion. They raised an argument that essentially said, we have trade secrets relating to the list of our customers, what they buy from us, et cetera, and you haven't shown a compelling need to justify providing that. And then they've also filed a request for or motion for protective order, asking the court to prevent them from being disclosed. Now, while that motion was briefed and pending, Hutchinson served a subpoena on a third party. DBL filed a supplemental request for protective order as to that third party and asked the court to either deem this information protected under trade secret law or enter a protective order providing that certain pricing information be produced by that third party, attorney's eyes only. Now, the outcome of that was the court granted the motion to compel, and the parties entered an agreed confidentiality order that allowed them to produce certain things with confidential and AEO protection. So, was it unreasonable? No. They resisted disclosing certain information, and the court ultimately gave them what they wanted and what DBL wanted with respect to confidentiality protection.
Could you spend just a minute talking about the post-trial, the
sure.
Espionage Act, and the apparently fake email and
sure.
all that, which is an intriguing tale?
Absolutely. It is, and let me just jump kind of to the conclusion there. DBL filed a motion for sanctions against Hutchinson. Hutchinson filed a motion for sanctions against DBL. Hutchinson's motion, which was derived from a sanctionable motion for sanctions, I suppose, Hutchinson's motion was denied by the trial court. The trial court found that there wasn't sufficient evidence to suggest that DBL did anything sanctionable in pursuing its motion, and DBL's motion hasn't been ruled on. That's the real conclusion there. Now, notwithstanding the facts that led us to that, I think it's just important to note that their motion on this issue was denied, and ours has not been ruled on. The facts, we've briefed them. I don't know if you want to rehear those, but I will talk about contempt, though, since you raised that earlier. Again, when we talk about sanctions and contempt, we're doing so acknowledging that there's only one case that we can all identify that's ever looked at these issues and said they're relevant. And in that case, if we give it full credibility for the standard it applies, it says that these facts are relevant to a willfulness and bad faith determination, meaning it has something to do, in my view, with infringement. Now, the sanctions issue, this conduct regarding an anonymous email threatening espionage and all these other things, has nothing to do with alleged unfair competition or infringement of a mark at all. And so I don't know how, if we give Spectrum full credit for what it says, how that has any bearing on this willful and bad faith finding.
Do these pending motions that are hanging out there have anything, do they have any bearing on the finality of the judgment?
No, they don't. So there's only one other pending motion now, and that would be this motion for contempt. DBL contends and has told the trial court that it thinks this is just an end run to go back and bolster this appeal that was argued below. They think, and they've argued below, that because the damages were so small, there's just an attempt to justify the whole conduct by getting fees. I'll withhold my judgment on that issue here. I do think, however, that what's happening is this is an effort below to simply get more relief than what the jury gave Hutchinson. It's just an attempt to expand the scope of relief, because what they're asking for below is $500 of contempt judgment per wheel sold, which would be hundreds of thousands of dollars that the jury didn't award them below. But on the issue of what's actually at stake, the court ordered DBL to not use Hutchinson in connection with any of its future sale of these wheels, and also to mark the wheel with a label, a permanent warning that says that these are remanufactured wheels and they don't carry warranties and other safety standards from the original manufacturer.
Now, in the interest of, so the $500 per wheel that they're seeking in this motion contempt, those are for wheels that are sold after the permanent injunction was ordered, correct?
That's correct, okay. Yes. And the record's not complete yet on this briefing issue. And to point out how incomplete it is, there's been some motion practice that's occurred, but there has been no live testimony offered by DBL or by anyone else for that matter to support any of these allegations of contempt or the conformance to the court's permanent injunction at all. So it's extremely premature. But to get to the issue of what is the conduct for purposes of should it be relevant, the conduct is alleged failure to apply this warning saying that this doesn't carry the same warranties as the original equipment, not using the mark, for example. And it's disputed. And the record that's before the court will show that both sides have briefed the issue, and that's all that's happened. So I don't think, standing alone, the contempt issue.
Is that even relevant to our exceptional determination if the trial court hadn't decided it yet?
Well, I would say it is definitely not. And I'll say it's not for two reasons. One, if we give Spectrum some credibility here, then this has nothing to do with whether the conduct of using this mark is willful at all. And two, it was before the court, this issue, when the court decided the motion for determining this is an exceptional case. And so the court had full discretion to consider these issues, the allegations in the briefing, the responses, and I think we have to leave that undisturbed because the court saw all of these things and made that determination in its discretion. I want to touch on one other issue that was referenced earlier about this request for inspection. Again, the argument being discovery misconduct. The record before the court will show there was some email exchange talking about dates for an inspection. DBL said it would consent to an inspection. It later said, I don't want to do the inspection. And then Hutchinson filed a motion to compel. Okay, there's one important step that was missing from all of that. They never served a Rule 196 request for inspection. They just hauled off to the court with a motion and said, we want to inspect the premises. So when we're talking about this motion to compel and the resulting work that came from it, and then the fact that they withdrew it after we agreed, I think it's extremely important to look through it with a lens of Hutchinson running to the courthouse for relief without ever serving a request, and then in the motion, of course, they never once referenced compliance with Rule 196 or attached the request because they didn't serve it.
So you concede that discovery abuses can get to the level of exceptional, but in this instance, you wouldn't characterize these things as discovery abuses.
I agree with your proposition that they can rise under a fair reading of Octane and other cases, but I would characterize everything below as being zealous advocacy. We've really talked about two isolated discovery disputes, one about customer lists and confidential customer information. That was resolved. It is what it is. Two, we're talking about an inspection where a request was never served and they filed a motion to compel. And then the parties worked it out and consented and agreed to an inspection. And that was that. So I don't know that two of these discovery issues standing alone, frankly, come anywhere near being a case that, to apply the standard, stands out from all of the other cases, especially in a commercial context when we're talking about two companies fighting over commercial sales of goods. So all right. I think I've covered all the issues that I had to talk about today with respect to the two prongs of our test. The trial court had full discretion to make this decision. I don't think that discretion should be disturbed here, especially given the record below. And so DBL Designs asks the court to affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Very briefly, Mr. Champion correctly notes that the court in Spectrum applied the wrong standard. He forgot to tell you or omits the fact that the wrong standard actually made it harder for the reversal, not easier. They applied a clear and convincing, not the preponderance standard, and nevertheless found that the conduct they outlined rose to the level of an abuse of discretion. So the wrong standard actually makes the case a stronger point in our favor, not a weaker one. On the issue of this concept of malice versus willfulness, malice is about, by deeming it willful, the jury said that the DBL conducted their conduct voluntarily with the intent to confuse or deceive potential purchasers, the purpose of which being to bring sales to himself. Malice is about whether he did it to harm us. Whether he did it to harm us is really irrelevant. I mean, it might be relevant if it was true, but it's certainly not a strike against. I mean, it would make our case stronger, I guess. On the issue
of, with respect to the strength of your case, then we also have to look about whether you were able to recover the damages that you sought.
I don't think so, Your Honor, and here's why. While winning a lot of money would be a factor that we would probably cite. The context in which these cases are brought, Lanham Act, plaintiffs like Hutchison, and this is borne out by the cases, but plaintiffs like Hutchison in trademark law, if you don't police your mark, you lose your mark. And so when companies like DBL infringe, they leave companies like Hutchison very little choice as to what to do. They have to file a lawsuit or get it resolved so they get them stopped. DBL wouldn't do that. I had parenthetically, we tried. But if Hutchison doesn't enter and file a lawsuit, then they may lose their mark. So they're forced into filing lawsuits like this. This is why there's fee-shifting provisions exist.
Well, so I noticed that you filed a JNOV on the jury's declining to award all the lost profits and disgorgement.
Yes, Your Honor.
For the trademark infringement and all that, but you haven't pursued that.
Correct.
Up here.
Correct. So I don't think, I mean, we believe that there was evidence of lost sales. The customers that at issue had purchased, there was testimony that they had purchased from Hutchison before, and they would have purchased from Hutchison had they known. The jury decided to do what the jury decided to do, and the court decided not to grant our JNOV, so I think that's that. I do think it's very important to note that in all of these cases, in many of the cases, no damages that were deemed exceptional, no damages were awarded at all. Some of them were deemed exceptional before at the summary judgment stage on liability. The injunction, I think, is a very important thing, which is that the main primary relief from a trademark holder's perspective and from Hutchison's perspective in terms of protecting its trademark, the ultimate goal of the lawsuit was to make this stop. And although you've heard that, you know, that's not going as swimmingly as we wanted, the permanent injunction that we sought was granted at the end of the trial because of the findings. And so I do think, Your Honor, hopefully that is kind of answers your question on the damages issue. Yeah, but I would agree with you that if we won a lot of money, that might make it more important. But I think that the purpose of this statute specifically, the Lanham Act, and why that's in there, it's really about the strength of your underlying substantive claim as to liability. Let's see if there's anything else. Is there anything else you guys would like me to respond to? Otherwise, I...
Did you just say that all of these exceptional cases, all of them had zero...
No, not all of them, but many of them. I'm sorry, Your Honor. No, that's they definitely, some of them definitely do have damages. However, I, you know, to the... Oh, the one other thing I'd like to address in my 58 seconds left is this concept that there was some basis for the antitrust claims that was unrelated to litigation conduct. I would encourage this court, if it's inclined to credit that, to go look at the briefing, because you will find that the conduct that he's describing, the communications with customers where they allegedly did all these bad things, was in fact the act that they're describing is our sending a letter that was authorized by the judge in discovery to the potential customers, notifying them of the lawsuit and asking them to whether they would be willing to talk to us. In other words, communicating with potential witnesses. At no point in their briefing do they ever suggest anything other than that this was anything other than nor covered litigation conduct, and they've never contended otherwise. So I think that claim is just it's simply not accurate. I appreciate the court's time. And
no, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, gentlemen, your case is submitted. We appreciate the argument. It's been very, very helpful, and you are now free to go about your day. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
All rise.